You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
March can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done, singly done. And by union, what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly done, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. And welcome again to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Judy Ansel. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Kansas City Building Trades Council and Teamsters Joint Council 56. The Kansas City Building Trades Council, the men and women who build KC, and Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We're proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum in their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, the Kansas City, Missouri School District just announced its Blueprint 2030, an ambitious plan of transformation, including the closing of 10 schools. Tonight on the show, we're going to be talking to Jason Roberts, president of the Kansas City Federation of Teachers, to get his reaction. Then, Dave Coleman is business manager of Ironworkers Local 10. Why do they call ironworkers cowboys in the sky? Is this a job for you and your son or daughter? It sure pays well. Find out tonight on the show. In the news, more organizing and more firings for organizing. And we're going to have an abbreviated news because it's Pledge Week. And we're going to be asking you, our listeners, to help support KKFI. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Michael Amish, and he's going to talk about how to stay safe on the job by understanding the OSHA rules. And now for the news.
Now news from our side, October 20th, 2022. Workers in an Apple store in Oklahoma City voted to unionize, making the second unionized Apple store in the U.S. in a matter of months, according to the Federal Labor Board. The vote on Friday signaled another win for the labor movement, which has been gaining momentum since the pandemic. However, this week we heard that an attempt by workers in an Albany, New York Amazon warehouse failed by a large margin, as workers rejected the Staten Island-based Amazon Labor Union. At the Oklahoma City Apple Store, 56 workers voted to be represented by the Communication Workers of America, while 32 voted against it, according to a preliminary tally by the National Labor Relations Board. The approximate number of eligible voters was 95, the board said. The Labor Board said Friday that both parties have 5 business days to file objections to the election. If no objections are filed, the results will be certified and the employer must begin bargaining in good faith with the union. The union's victory follows a vote to unionize at an Apple store in Towson, Maryland in June, led by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. In a statement emailed to the Associated Press on Saturday, Apple said, "We believe the direct, open, and collaborative relationship we have with our valued team members is the best way to provide an excellent experience for our customers and for our teams. Evidently, the Oklahoma workers opted out for more respect and less BS."
The Missouri Workers' Center reports that over 40 workers at Amazon's STLA Fulfillment Center in St. Peters, Missouri, marched on the boss and delivered a petition to management signed by over 350 of their co-workers demanding better pay, safer working conditions, and off-site digital access to the company's policy manual. In response to the demands of STLA workers and similar demands from Amazon workers across the country, Amazon announced a $1 an hour raise.
Meanwhile, Starbucks was ordered by the National Labor Relations Board to reinstate workers fired because of their support of a union in an Overland Park store. But now they've fired a worker at Independence at the first store to go union. C.J. Miller, age 19, was on the bargaining committee when Starbucks fired him on October 4th, allegedly for violating the company's timekeeping policy. But Miller says he kept photos of when he clocked out for a half-hour break, and Starbucks has its facts wrong. In response to Miller's firing, workers walked off the job for a few hours last weekend, according to the Independence Examiner. Miller has filed unfair labor practice charges with the NLRB and remains on the union's negotiating committee, even though he's not allowed to work. Tonight's news was read by Tom Gebkin, Bennett Nowanti, and I'm Judy Morgan.
And now it's Pledge Drive. And, of course, KKFI, as you probably already know, is your community radio station. We don't get corporate dollars. We don't have advertising. And we need our listeners, of course, to support the station. And you get what you pay for. So, of course, the Heartland Labor Forum, as you also probably know, is the only labor show in the Midwest. I think there's another one in Champaign, Illinois. I think there's one in Chicago. But around here, we're it. And if you think that we ought to have labor news and labor stories and labor features and issues and union folks on the air, then please call us at 888-931-0901 and support the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. And with me here to help pitch are Tom Gebkin and Judy Morgan. Judy, why don't you go first? Why do you think it's important?
Well, you know, Judy, you're the one who got me involved. Uh-huh. when I was no longer president of the teachers union, when I'd retired, and you said, hey, you've got some time on your hands, Judy Morgan, come help us out at Heartland Labor Forum. Of course, I was familiar with your show because you had graciously had me on it over the years whenever we were facing difficult situations with the district, just like we're going to have our current president on with us tonight. So that's why it's important to me, because I think, like you say, labor unions, working people don't get the kind of coverage they should, and Heartland Labor Forum does it. And I just want to give you accolades. I think you've done a wonderful job over the years keeping us all involved. And sorry, that's terrible. My phone just went off.
One of the things we say at the beginning of the show
is
turn off your phones, right?
Exactly. But I am so sorry.
Our phones are on here, and you can call 888-931-0901 and make a pledge to the Heartland Labor Forum. And Tom, how about you?
Well, I saw you at many different events, many different meetings, and I don't know exactly how you talked me into coming down here, but
Both of you guys are naturals on the air, so I'm real grateful.
But I came down and I really enjoy it. I've got to meet a lot of different people in the labor movement, the labor leader series that Judy and myself work on. We've met a lot of good people that are local leaders. We take their profile and we put it out on the air. And then the whole city and all of our listeners get to meet them over the radio.
And know that they're not union thugs or goons or anything. They're just honest people trying to represent their members, right?
That's part of our goal.
Yeah.
And I just, one of the shows Tom and I did, I think around the end of last year, was a tribute to Herb Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
And I just think that was one of my favorite shows of all time. We brought in, you know, different union folks who knew him and loved him, and he passed away very unexpectedly.
And it's a year this week since he died.
Right, it's a year since he passed away, and so many of us loved him, and to be able to pay tribute to him, it meant a lot to me. I know it meant a lot to his wife, his family, to all of his union colleagues, and where else could you get that except on Heartland Labor Forum?
Right, and Herb was a former union president and officer of the Missouri AFL-CIO. So if you like this kind of programming, what do? You call us at
888-931-0901.
Or you pledge online at
KKFI.org. That's easy to remember.
That's right. And it's real easy to pledge, too. And Stephen, you want to say anything? Stephen's our engineer.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. This is community radio at its finest. This is why you want that station.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Yep. 888-931-0901. Give us a call.
Welcome to the first half of the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Judy Morgan, President Emeritus of the Kansas City Federation of Teachers and School-Related Personnel, Local 691, and former Missouri State Rep. I'll be co-hosting this segment with my good friend, Tom Gepkin, who is President of the Communication Workers of America, Local 6360. The Kansas City Public School District has faced many crises over the years, including school closings. It's dealing with school closings again, but this time with several interesting factors not in place before. We're delighted to have as our guest Jason Roberts, President of the AFT Local 691, the union that represents the teachers and school employees in the Kansas City Public Schools. And Jason will explain Kansas City Blueprint 2030, the school district's plan for transforming and closing schools. And welcome, Jason, and thank you for being with us tonight. I know you're very busy with everything going on in the district, so we really appreciate you being there.
Well, thanks for having me.
You are welcome. Well, let's start with a very basic question. There have been some articles, I know, in the Kansas City Star, and I'm guessing on other local media outlets, too, about the Kansas City Blueprint 2030. Just kind of give us a brief overview of it to begin with.
So what Kansas City Public Schools has realized is that we are not competing with the suburbs around us in what we can offer our students. When you look at the opportunities that they have in Liberty and North Kansas City and Lee Summit and Blue Valley and even some opportunities in Independence and Raytown, we're not able to keep up with that. And part of that is because the data shows that we are the number one spender in all of the metro for building operations. And we are second to last in what actually goes into the classroom. And so what we've realized is we need to flip that. And that requires making some hard decisions. The ultimate goal in that, as far as what is Blueprint 2030, it's a plan to offer those very types of programs to our students.
Can you give us an example of just a few of those?
Sure. So one of the things we would like to do is to offer foreign language to all elementary students starting in kindergarten, a very European model. So in kindergarten, as you're learning English, you begin to learn primarily Spanish. Also doing fine arts expansion, things like choir and band in elementary school, as well as other opportunities in secondary. Expanding our strings in elementary school. Creating science labs in our elementary school. Creating music and art therapy in all of our schools for trauma-informed learning. Competency-based education, which is kind of a new thing on the scene for our secondary students, allowing them to kind of control their own learning and take some ownership over that. And also having this thing called lead teachers, which are teachers that perhaps was kind of like an instructional coach model of the past, teachers that teach half of the day and then spend the other half of the day assisting peers and modeling and so on.
And it's my understanding, Jason, to get the funds to do the things you were just talking about, and because they spend so much money on building operations, they want to close some schools. They're tied together, correct?
That's correct. They're tied to a couple things here. Number one is closing some schools automatically in phase one this year. And then a little more contentious right now is a ballot initiative and getting some additional fundings for our schools. We have not done that since 1967.
Yes, I actually remember that.
Well, the Kansas City Public Schools, they have 37 schools right now. and 10 buildings will be closed over the next next few years. They include Northeast High School, Central High School, and 8 elementary schools. Do you know the rationale for these proposed closings of these schools as they weighed everything? How did they determine that these were the schools that needed to be closed?
So there were a couple factors that went in for each one, and I'll kind of go through them quickly. Central High School, a very historic school, has an enrollment of 472 with a 5-year projected enrollment trend of negative 29. It also has a building score, if you understand anything about building scores, of 6.91 out of 10, which means it has some infrastructure issues. It has a total deferred maintenance cost of $14.44 million to fix those maintenance issues, as well as a projected population change in the area of negative 4.60. Faxon, which would be a later school, has an enrollment of 285 with a projected enrollment of negative 17. And also a building score of 5.5 with $2.75 million in deferred maintenance. James has 236 with a deferred maintenance of 4.37. King has 360 students with a deferred maintenance of 3.77 million. Longfellow has 235 students with a deferred maintenance of 6.55 million. Melcher has 310 with a deferred maintenance of 5.64 million. Northeast High has 605 students in it with a deferred maintenance of 6.16 million. Troost has 252 students with 4.33 million deferred. Wheatley has 358 with an $8.17 million deferred maintenance. And Whittier has 346 with a $6.25 million deferred maintenance.
So basically the district looked at the schools that had declining enrollment. Just for an example, you talked about Central. When I started teaching there in 1970 in the old building, we had 2,500 kids, and you're talking 400 now.
We're talking 472.
Yeah, and then also that some of these buildings had deferred a lot of maintenance, so those are the ones they're thinking about closing.
When you add it all up, it totals a little over $30 million in deferred maintenance just to keep these buildings operating. And, of course, Central has a capacity of about 1,600, somewhere around there, and only 472 students in it with a projected population decline of almost 5%. So there were a lot of considerations that the district actually put into this as they were making these decisions.
Okay. I want to ask you, because, you know, obviously I have a lot of history in the district.
You do.
Not only lived there, taught there, my daughter went there, so I have a lot of love for the district. When I started teaching there in 1970, we actually had 70,000 kids, and we had 100 schools about. When I became union president in 99, we had dropped to about 35,000 students in 70 schools. I believe you're at around 27 schools now, and the district's going to their plan is to close 10 more to bring it down to 27. So talk to our listeners about what's your opinion on what has caused, obviously there's been a decrease in student population, which has caused some of the problems the district is facing now. So what do you think?
There are a couple factors that we have to look at. Number one, of course, is the continued movement to the suburbs. Mm-hmm. We also have to remember that Kansas City as a city is not just Kansas City Public Schools. And we're unique in that way. Unlike St. Louis, we share boundaries with other districts. So people may move a few blocks over and be in a brand new district. I think there are a couple things, though, that have hit us hard. One of them is we have 20 charter schools in the city of Kansas City. We will almost have as many charter schools as we have what I call union schools, which would be our district. So we've got 20 closed shop and potentially 27 union schools. But we also have to remember that there has been across the country a serious population decline. The number of people having children has decreased. And so the number of children able to even attend school in our city has decreased tremendously. And we're seeing other urban cores like Cincinnati and New York City and Indianapolis go through this very thing as well.
Yeah, and I think kind of another issue is the independent schools. I was around when we lost 7 schools, which was a considerable, a high school, a middle school, and I think 5 elementary back in about 2007, which also took some of the student population. So there's been, I think there have been, like you say, a lot of factors that have contributed to this.
But we are going to leave Pitcher open.
Okay. Okay, good.
We're talking with Jason Roberts. He's president of the American Federation of Teachers, Local 691, and we're discussing the closing of Kansas City Public Schools. What was the position of the union on KC Blueprint 2030?
The process started in 2019. So the process of doing this work actually started under my predecessor. And the union did not have a public opinion at that time. With the rollout, I've been involved heavily in the discussions and some of the decision making. And the union was able to support this plan with two conditions and caveats. Number one, we should not reduce a single position in this district, which will be a historic agreement between the district and the union. And secondly, we need smaller class sizes. The union will not support taking students and moving them from building to building and squashing them in like sardines. Mm-hmm. Our students deserve quality learning environments. And so as we've talked through it, we've come to some agreement on those things, but also, you know, understand things may change.
Well, I think it's great that you've been able to get some kind of agreement. So is that like an MOU, or is it verbal, or do you have video?
It's in video.
Okay, so you have some kind of documentation.
We do. we have it in video and in writing. One of the things that we've done is Dr. Carter, the interim superintendent, and myself recorded a video together where she addressed the staff and then I addressed the staff. And we both talked about the need to keep every single employee. It is better in the midst of a teacher shortage and a staff shortage to be overstaffed than understaffed. But let's be real, teachers are leaving. So we're gonna have a lot of attrition. And then we also did it in writing because HR and I understood that the contract language that we have right now for school closures is cumbersome and offensive to our teachers. It would require them to re-interview at every single potential school, which is offensive to a professional. Mm-hmm. So we wiped that out.
Well, we're going
to do a very union, a pro-union policy. We're going to go by seniority, and the teacher will get to choose, and the principal will have no say.
Oh, I like that.
With the teachers are all squared away, but what about the support staff that is at each school?
They will all keep their jobs. No one in the AFT units, any of them, will lose their job.
So that goes across all. I know you represent five different groups, so that goes across all five of the groups, the paraprofessionals, secretaries, security officers.
We're up to 17 groups.
Oh, you have 17. Wow.
I've added four since I've been president.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
But yes,
everybody's covered.
Everyone will be covered.
Okay, very good. So the KC Blueprint 2030 was first introduced at the school board, I believe, about 1 week ago. And as I recall, you were going to meet with your executive board. I think you've had a general membership meeting mm-hmm. since then, so you've had time to talk to your members. So how have they been reacting?
I did meet with my executive board on Wednesday ahead of time, and that came advice well heeded from a president emeritus, Judy Morgan, who said that would be a wise thing to do, and I took that very seriously. And then we went to the school board meeting. I had my negotiating team with me in the room for the entire presentation. And then before the membership meeting, I went to three of the schools that were closed with the district. So I joined 3 in the morning and talked with staff, and then I did the official announcements with the district at 3 of the schools, Northeast High School, James Elementary, and George Melcher Elementary. And I have to say, there are some passions among our members at those schools. Teachers become very attached to each other. You become like a second family, right. And you become attached to your students. You become attached to your facilities, your classroom, things like that. So there are some people that are thrilled. They want a new building. Mm-hmm. There are some people that are kind of laissez-faire. I'll take what I get as long as I have a job. And then there are people that are saying, you know what, I'm sad about this and I want to fight back. And I certainly encourage them to use their voice, to attend the community sessions, to fight back as they feel necessary, waiting to see what the board does in December. But the membership in general has been, from what I understand, from people that have some historical knowledge, far more calm than we have had in the past when we've done school closures. And I would loathe for just a minute that I have been blessed by the BOE to give me credit for that, mm-hmm. by being so public so fast.
Mm-hmm. So the ones that are sad, you said some teachers are sad. Mm-hmm. Are they people who have been there a long time generally?
10 years or more. It's predominantly James right now. We have a teacher that's been there for 40 years.
Wow.
Only school she's ever worked in.
Wow.
I'm her 5th union president.
Well, that is a long time to be at one building, yes, so you can understand why there'd be some misgivings.
It's a lot to pack up if you know elementary teachers.
Yeah, and just and I think you're wrong. I agree with you totally. The teachers become, and the school employees, it is like a second family. You spend a lot of time at school with your colleagues and the kids, and it's kind of an emotional issue.
It really is.
My daughter is a third grade teacher in a different school district here in the metro, and she really cares about her students, and I'm sure all teachers do. Mm-hmm. The school board, they've set up some community meetings throughout the district, both in person and virtual, to discuss the Blueprint 2030. Several of those meetings, they've already been held. What's the reaction of the community?
It's been interesting. I had a principal call me and say, I saw you on the news standing in the corner, and we're used to you being in the front. And I said, yes, I was in the corner with my tail between my legs. The one at Southeast Community Center was quite a raucous situation. They ended up actually shutting down the presentation, and people were yelling at each other and things like that. Central last night, I thought, went very well. It was packed. But the community obviously is going to come out. They're going to speak. Most of the conversation has revolved around Central High School, and it is predominantly alumni.
Well, it's interesting. I read the article, I don't know if it was maybe a couple of days ago or maybe yesterday, about the Central meeting, and two people were quoted. Both of them were former students of mine from Central High School. So, yeah, I remembered their names. So I actually had taught both of them, and I guess they've stayed active in the Alumni Association over the years. So, Central's one of those schools that really had a lot of pride, mm-hmm. and Northeast, too, because I was at both of those, Central and Northeast. So both of them have a lot of pride, and both of them have had really good alumni associations, I think.
We'll have to do a show on the parallels between my career and yours.
Yeah, so anyway. So do you think the school board's unified behind the plan, Jason? Can you tell, or is it possible to tell?
I have to say I have absolutely no read on that at this point. Based on the school board meeting and then based on the community feedback, I'm not sure what will happen in December.
Okay, because is that the
December 14th is the day that they will vote.
Okay, so that's when they'll vote on whether to accept this plan or is it possible it could be modified between now and then?
Change schools, yes, it's all on the table.
Okay, so that's interesting. So you think the school board really is listening people at the meetings?
I do.
Okay, I think we're out of time. So we really want to thank you, Jason Roberts, president of the Kansas City Federation of Teachers and School-Related Personnel, Local 691. You have shared much helpful information about this issue that your union is facing, and we wish you the best of luck as it goes along. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason.
Hello, I'm Kelly Doherty, the new Director of Development and Communications at KKFI. I'm asking you to show your support of KKFI this pledge drive by either picking up the phone and dialing 888-931-0901 or by getting online at kkfi.org and clicking the donate button in the top right-hand corner. Every bit helps support KKFI, our community radio.
KKFI would like to thank Urban Cafe for feeding our volunteers during this fund drive. Urban Cafe is located at 5500 Troost Avenue in Kansas City, Missouri, or online at urbancafekc.com.
Okay, and once again, it's Pledge Week, and I'm Judy Ansel. I want to thank a bunch of people who donated to my Facebook fundraiser. I want to thank Mary McGinn, Steve Gold, Aubra Ruiz, Lynn Snyder, Mary Ario, Trudy White, Allie Bush, Donnie Morehouse, Jansen Thomas, Marissa Butler, who has her show tomorrow morning, tune in, Jimmy Lappy, and Lori Bretz. And I think we're going to thank Jason for a donation and Judy as well. And you, too, can donate.
You can put me down for a donation.
We're going to put Tom down for a donation, too. But we need our listeners to donate as well. And you can do that by calling 888-931-0901. Any reason why, Tom, you're giving?
This show is very interesting, and it talks about good topics, interesting topics, and I want to keep it going.
Yeah, keep KKFI going. How about you, Judy?
Same way. You know, this is my second stint working with it, and I just love the way the volunteers work together on the program. And Judy takes a bunch of us ragtags who know nothing and helps us learn how to get on the radio.
We fumble and bumble along the way.
What I love is the midnight calls from one of our volunteers. He says, "How do you do this?"
She's helped me many times when I've been in a jam, as has Tom. He's helped me out too when I've been in a jam. So we work together.
Right.
Well.
I mean, that's the thing about KKFI that's so wonderful is it's, you know, we're all volunteers. We have very few staff. Everybody who's on the air is a volunteer. We have no paid programmers. And it's really a community effort. Like Stephen here, who is our engineer, who just walked in off the street one day and said, "I want to learn to engineer." And here he is.
And history was made.
Yes, right. History was made. And you, too, can make history by donating to KKFI at 888-931-0901.
And I appreciate Stephen, too, because I think it's a lot more fun to come into the studio and do the interviews. We do have to do them on Zoom sometimes. Of course, during the pandemic, we had to do it a lot. But it's really great to be in the studio again and have our engineer working with us. So we appreciate you, too.
Oh, it's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. So give us a call, 888-931-0901, or go online to kkfi.org and make a pledge.
My daddy used to point them out to me whenever we were taking a drive. He'd say, "Son, there's another one the way iron workers done makes you proud just to be alive." And I'd swell up with pride at the sight of it all. How in the world could they build them so tall? And what kind of men were these iron workers who built such a world big enough for us all? They were built like my dad, giant and true. They'd gleam in the sun in a deep sky blue. They'd span across rivers and reshape the world. Dad always made sure that I knew. He'd say,
many people drive to work in Kansas City Metro. That means crossing bridges built by iron workers. They may work in a big, tall building, only possible because an iron worker put the structure together before anything else is added to the frame. Think big bridges like the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, the St. Louis Gateway Arch, the Empire State Building, the list goes on. These brave iron workers are on top of the structures out in the open. These men and women, or as they are sometimes called, cowboys of the sky, face all weather conditions, heat, cold, wind. They have a deadline to meet. No other trade can get in until they complete their dangerous work. On tonight's Labor Leaders series, hosted by Judy Morgan, retired president of American Federation of Teachers, and myself, Tom Gepkin, president of CWA Local 6360, we will talk to Dave Coleman, financial secretary, treasurer, and business manager of Iron Workers Local 10. He is also a delegate on the St. Louis District Council. In addition to his service to Local 10, Dave is also president of the Greater Kansas City Building and Construction Trades, executive board member of the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO, and chairman on the MOCAN Iron Workers Apprenticeship and Training, Pension, Annuity, and Health and Welfare Funds.
Welcome, Dave, to the Heartland Labor Forum. Let's start by letting our audience know what an iron worker does and why you decided to do this dangerous job and just kind of the trajectory of your career in this field.
Thank you, Judy. So you don't actually pick being an iron worker. I believe it picks you. Okay. And so I've always been a person that liked to work outdoors, work with my hands, and welder. And so I'll be honest with you, I was 20 years old, and I was working in a weld shop in Marshall, Missouri, and I needed health insurance because I had a baby on the way. So I knew some people in the union, and I asked how I put an application in, and my very first day was July 3rd, 1993.
And where was that?
So that happened to be at the Ford plant. It was supposed to last for 2 weeks, so I quit a job to become a union iron worker apprentice. And I go to the Ford plant, worked the first day. It was actually, that day was July 3rd. And worked that day and worked July 4th and got laid off. And I had a new family coming. So I almost went back to my old job when I got that layoff check because I didn't know how to take that. No one had prepared me just to get laid off after 2 days. And I went home, talked to my family. I went to the union hall the next morning and sat there for a few hours, and they came out and said, "So you want to go to work?" I said, "Yes, sir." And they sent me to Bartle Hall. And so I went to Bartle Hall.
Was this when it was just being built?
Yes, when it was being built. Wow. Yeah, before the tires were up. Uh-huh. Mm. And I went there, and I was a bolt punk. And what that is just putting bolts together for the journeyman and taking the bolts to them. And that's how I started.
Do you consider it a dangerous job?
Ironwork is inherently dangerous. There's a lot of safety procedures in place. And the number one safety out there is your brother, right? Brother and sister members, we all look out for each other. And so that's a big part. But we spend hundreds of hours training on safety, everything from subpart R to control decking zone, crane and signaling, CPR, OSHA 30. So there's a lot of hours spent. We're very proud of our apprenticeship program. I've got a really good director of training and a good team down there at the apprenticeship. We also have apprenticeship in Springfield, and safety is the number one concern for iron workers. Yes.
Do they, you know, we look back and we've seen that photo of the iron workers. They're eating lunch on the beam in like the 1920s or whenever they were building, maybe like the Empire State Building. No safety equipment at all. But it's very dangerous, but safety has become the standard, and it is an important part of the industry. Do you guys self-police each other, too? Like, if you see somebody not doing something right, do you go tap them on the top of the head and tell them to get it together? Or
Tom, absolutely. That's number one. Safety is the number one concern. No one wants to see something happen to a brother. We all got families to go home to, and so we all look out for each other.
So in terms of the safety, did that come about as a result of union negotiations, putting those procedures in place?
Yes. The safety, unions, that's the number one concern for unions also, right, is to protect our workers, our workforce. Mm-hmm. It's not just the contractor. It's the brotherhood. We all work together to keep each other safe. The International Iron Workers actually has a guy named Steve Rank, who I'm very proud to say he's a local 10 member. He's with the International Iron Workers. And every day that's what he's out there doing, is trying to make the job site safer and dealing with OSHA, working on regulations for OSHA, and to keep workers safe. And it's not just for iron workers. It's for every construction worker out there.
Well, I see that as a big benefit to unions, so is putting those safety measures in place, because I don't think management does that for you. You have to get out there and fight for it.
Yeah, to be honest with you, if management puts something in place, it's because the insurance company told them to.
Okay.
Right? Not saying, don't get me wrong, we're partners with management.
Right.
And it's a team. It takes both sides. But, that's old school talking. Safety was important as long as the schedule was met. Now, yeah. I will say the last 20 years, things have really changed. And safety is number one. I think it's for everyone in the industry, not just the union side.
All the crafts, building Correct. Trades and crafts. So tell us about Local 10. How many members do you have, and what geographic area does your local actually represent, and what are the kinds of jobs? I don't think it's just one job they do. What are the kind of jobs your members do?
So I feel like you're picking on me with three questions, but I'll do it.
Okay.
So we have 1,000 members, active working members. That's not an inflated number. We have 1,000 working members. 800 of those are journey persons, and we have about 160 apprentices, and the rest are probationary members, which is something I like to talk about a little bit.
Okay.
So a lot of times someone doesn't know what an iron worker is, and they want to try it, so they can come down, and as long as we can get them a job, which fortunately work is really good right now, and we're going to have a lot of opportunities for men and women to come down and sign up. and they can come down and we put them in as a probationary member for up to 1 year, and they can get in there and see if they even like it or not. But we also, before they actually go to work, we make sure everyone has OSHA 10. They go down to the training center, get OSHA 10, learn how to tie off correctly, which is obviously a big deal for an iron worker, and just learn the basic skills.
Now, what's OSHA 10?
OSHA 10 is just a basic safety that OSHA requires. There's an OSHA 10 and an OSHA 30.
Okay.
But OSHA 10, Missouri state law says that you have to have OSHA 10 to be on the job site.
Okay. So that protects the safety of the workers then?
Absolutely. Because there's a lot of times that a new worker will go somewhere and just, they get out there, they don't even know how to put a harness on.
Yeah. So what geographic area do you represent? A fairly big one?
Yeah. So it's been really fun for me, the geographic area. So I'll go north to south first. We have a huge area. We have half of Missouri and a third of Kansas.
Oh my goodness.
Very fortunate to have a good team. I have an agent in Topeka, that's Tony Dillage. He's out to Topeka. He goes all the way out to Fort Riley, Kansas. And the going south, I have Justin Caton. He has an office in Springfield. But he goes all the way to the Arkansas line. So north to south, as I was starting to say, north to south, we go from the Iowa line to the Arkansas line. And then east to west, we go to the Missouri River Bridge, the center of the Missouri River. That's where the line is between us and St. Louis. We go from there all the way to Fort Riley, Kansas, to the west.
That's a lot of area.
It is a lot of area. Pretty much, if you're a business agent for Local 10, you're going to drive 40,000 miles a year covering the work.
Shifting gears just a little bit, along the way you decided to get involved with your union. Would you tell us about that, your journey to the top position?
So, Tom, that's a funny one. so, much like being an iron worker, the journey to the top position, you know, you don't choose that. The membership chooses you, the leadership before you chooses you. The number one thing to say about that is I've always been a guy that I show up every day, ready to go to work from day one. And when you do that, work hard, everything else takes care of itself. Once I became a journeyman in 1996, started attending all the union meetings, the number one thing, first, take care of the work. If you take care of the work, people will notice and you have an opportunity to move up. Started on the door in 2000 as Sergeant of Arms. And during my tenure, I've had every position in the local except recording secretary, and I've been an executive board member. I've been vice president, president, business manager, agent, organizer. So I've pretty much done all the positions and worked my way up. And it was never necessarily a goal. It was just show up every day and do my job, and everything took care of itself. And I told the apprentices that when I go down and talk to them that, hey, this deal, you might be sitting beside the next business manager. You never know.
So did you have any interesting stories as Sergeant at Arms? I'm guessing you were there at the meetings to make sure order prevailed.
Well, that's the job of the Sergeant at Arms. And yeah. When you start out young, they like to test you. Iron workers, we have a lot of characters. We got a lot of really good, strong union members. Uh-huh. And they, I'll be honest, I had a guy that was one of the rough ones from the old days. And he came up and he asked me, he said, "Kid, you sure you got big enough balls for this job?" And I said, "Yes, sir."
So did that settle him down?
It must have, because here I am.
Okay. Well, let's talk about women in the trade. How do you have a lot of women in the trade? What are you doing to try to get more women in the trade?
So, Judy, I'll be honest with you. It's a great question. We do have women in the trade. We have really changed our program. We're reaching out to get women in. I wish we had more. Funny thing that no one ever talks about, women are really, really good welders. And that's kind of a secret that a lot of people don't know. The unfortunate part for iron worker, we're not just welders. So we weld the structure together, we bolt the structure together. So just to get into iron workers and think you're going to be a welder, you're not just going to be a welder, right? We call them all around cowboys. and you've got to be able to do it all. And that, and back, that's back to the work, right? So I never did answer your question earlier. We do structural, which is all your beams and your bridges. But before that can go up, you have your concrete reinforcing. And that's the rebar that goes into concrete that reinforces that. Once the structure's up, then we have ornamental work. And the ornamental work is your big glass, your curtain wall systems. That's iron workers do that. Contrary to popular belief, we actually do curtain walls all over the country. And there's also the stairs, handrail, that's all part of ornamental law. So miscellaneous steel and ornamental.
And do you mostly do big building construction as opposed to residential?
We don't really have a presence in residential. If you have a really, really big project, we may go out and put the reinforcing in the concrete and put the main support beams in for the structure.
Okay.
But typically we don't have a lot on residential.
Okay, tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum, we're talking to Dave Coleman, who is with the Ironworkers Local 10. Let's talk about where you think your local is going to go during your tenure. I know it was, for me, a really big deal when we defeated Right to Work several, I guess it's been almost 4 years ago now.
2018.
Yeah, right, almost 4 years ago, and that was pretty spectacular, I thought. So, taking that into consideration, where do you want your local to be, say, like 5 or 10 years down the road? And talk about how you work with your executive board, because I know as a former union president myself, you've got to have an executive board that works with you to make things happen.
Okay, so first question is where I'd like to see the local in the next 5 years. any leader is going to tell you that they want their local to grow, and because that's the lifeblood, bring new people in, new members, new men and women into the trade, to continue on with the tradition of being a union iron worker, union craftsperson. And so that's we have a business plan in place to grow 20% in the next 5 years. And I truly believe in my heart we're going to get there.
Dave, are you participating in the BUD program with the AFL-CIO?
Yes, we are. Bob Knatcher is a director of training down at the school. Anyone that goes through that program is a direct entry into the iron workers. Matter of fact, we have really stepped that game up, and that's how we are recruiting more females. Is if they go through, there's a list of programs that's a direct entry. If they go through that program, just a job training program, it's not nothing about iron workers. We just need people that want to go to work, that will show up every day. If I have someone that'll show up every day on time, ready to go to work, we'll train them to be iron workers. You don't have to know how to be an iron worker to be an iron worker. You just got to know how to go to work.
I know the building trades are looking to have an increase in minorities and women in all the building trades.
So let's tell our listeners what the BUD program is, just kind of briefly.
The BUD program is it's designed to attract minorities and women into the building trades. They noticed that there was not very many in the building trades, and they want to increase that, and they want to reflect what's going on out in the United States to into that program.
Yeah, let me touch base on that. On the BUD program, it is a great program, okay? But what everybody doesn't understand is that we're always recruiting men and women of color into the trades. The problem is them actually knowing about the trade. So the BUD program, in my mind, is more outreach than anything else. It's all about connecting the dots. If there's people want opportunity. If you give people opportunity, they'll take it.
So let's say if someone's interested in becoming an iron worker, what advice would you give them? What should they do?
So everything we've been talking about is kind of crazy. We've made it so much easier. Back 20, 30 years ago, even 10 years ago, if you didn't know somebody, if your neighbor down the street wasn't an iron worker, if your dad wasn't an iron worker, you didn't have a chance to get in. And we've totally changed that all the way around. So we actually have an app now, Iron Worker app, but to make it simple, you go to ironworkers10.com, go to the apprenticeship tab, click on that, and then we have an application right there. You just fill the application out. I will say this, please fill it out 100% because my director of training is very strict, and we've directed him to be that way And that is, if you can't fill that application out, we don't need you. So please take your time to fill the application out. Once you do that, anyone that fills an application out complete will get an interview. And we're very proud of that.
So, Dave, do they have to have any prior, like, high school degree or GED?
Yes, you have to have a high school diploma, GED, and also a driver's license. Because, again, we've talked about the jurisdiction. If you can't get to work, there's no way you're going to be successful. Okay. And we're very adamant about making sure that we're setting people up for success and not failure. Okay.
So if a person passes the apprentice program, moves into the journeyman, and this is their career, what can they expect?
So as far as benefits goes, Tom?
Benefits all the way to retirement.
Okay. So number one, we have a great health care plan. Anyone that gets in the iron workers ends up with benefits for their entire family. Health insurance benefits, that's dental, eye care, everything, and we're very proud of that. It doesn't matter if there's one person, if it's one iron worker or the whole family. Mm. Once you have insurance, your whole family qualifies.
Wonderful.
That's a phenomenal benefit. Well, Dave Coleman, thank you so much for being with us tonight. We really appreciated hearing about the iron workers, Local 10, the work you do. You gave us a lot of information and insight. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Dave.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of Know Your Rights. This is Michael Amash with the law firm of Blake & Euleb. In December of 1970, then-President Richard Nixon signed the Occupational Safety and Health Act into law. Under OSHA, employers are responsible for providing a safe and healthful workplace for their workers. OSHA covers most private sector employers and some public sector workers as well. Under OSHA, employers have the responsibility to provide a safe workplace to their workers. Employers must provide their workers with a workplace that does not have serious hazards and must follow all OSHA safety and health standards. Employers must find and correct safety and health problems. OSHA further requires that employers first try to eliminate or reduce hazards by making changes in working conditions rather than relying on personal protective equipment such as masks, gloves, or earplugs, switching to safer chemicals, including processes to trap harmful fumes, or using ventilation systems to clean the air are examples of effective ways to eliminate or reduce risks. OSHA establishes standards to protect workers. Some examples of those standards include requirements for employers to provide fall protection, prevent trenching cave-ins, prevent exposure to some infectious diseases, ensure the safety of workers who enter confined spaces, prevent exposure to harmful chemicals, put guards on dangerous machines, provide respirators or other safety equipment, and provide training for certain dangerous jobs in a language and vocabulary workers can understand. In addition, employers must also comply with the General Duty Clause of the OSHA. This clause requires employers to keep the workplace free of serious recognized hazards and is generally cited when no specific OSHA standard applies to a hazard. Under OSHA, employers must maintain certain records and documents in order to ensure compliance. Employers must prominently display the official OSHA job safety and health poster in the workplace, inform workers about chemical hazards through training, labels, alarms, and color-coded systems, provide safety training to workers, keep accurate records of work-related injuries and illnesses, perform tests in the workplace such as air sampling required by OSHA standards, provide required personal protective equipment at no cost to workers, provide hearing exams or other medical tests as required by OSHA standards, post OSHA citations and injury and illness data where workers can see them, and notify OSHA within 8 hours of a workplace fatality or within 24 hours of any work-related inpatient hospitalization, amputation, or loss of an eye. OSHA provides rights and protections to workers. Workers have the right to file a confidential complaint with OSHA to have their workplace inspected, receive information and training about hazards, methods to prevent harm, and OSHA standards to apply at their workplace, receive copies of records of work-related injuries and illnesses that occur in their workplace, receive copies of the results from tests and monitoring done to find and measure hazards in the workplace, receive copies of their workplace medical records, participate in OSHA inspection and speak in private with an inspector,
File a complaint with OSHA if they have been retaliated against by their employer. File a complaint with OSHA if punished or retaliated against for acting as a whistleblower. This whistleblower protection is a significant part of OSHA's enforcement mechanism. To help ensure that workers are free to participate in safety and health activities, OSHA prohibits any person from discharging or in any manner retaliating against any worker for exercising rights under OSHA. These rights include raising safety and health concerns with an employer, reporting a work-related injury or illness, filing a complaint with OSHA, seeking an OSHA inspection, participating in an OSHA inspection, and participating or testifying in a proceeding related to an OSHA inspection. Protection from retaliation is broad. It means the employer cannot retaliate by taking, quote, adverse action against any worker. Adverse action may include firing or laying off, blacklisting, demoting, denying overtime or promotion, disciplining, denying of benefits, failing or refusing to hire or rehire, making any threats, intimidating, or reassigning an individual for promotion. In order to ensure their workplace is safe, current employees or their representatives, such as the labor union, may file a written complaint and ask OSHA to inspect their workplace if they believe there is a serious hazard or that their employer is not following OSHA standards. Workers and their representatives have the right to ask for an inspection without OSHA telling their employer who filed the complaint. In order to learn more about OSHA, please go to OSHA.gov. This is all about time we have this month for Know Your Rights. This is Mike Amash. Be well.
And thank you, Mike Amash. He volunteers his time to teach us about the law. And you, of course, are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. And, of course, I'm going to ask you for money because it's Pledge Drive Week. And we have bills to pay here at KKFI. And we also have some premiums, too. So if you want to give and get a long sleeve T-shirt, that's a KKFI T-shirt, that is $10 a month. Become a monthly donor. Or $120 one time. And we also, of course, have the guest DJ. And with the holidays coming up, giving your loved one or your kid, who is not just a kid, but, you know, like over 16 or so, a guest DJ certificate could be the right gift for you. It gives them an hour of pick their own music and be a DJ on KKFI, and that is $150 one time or $12.50 a month. So we have those little premiums, but the main thing is to pledge and support KKFI at 888-931-0901. You want to say anything, Stephen?
It's been a pleasure engineering for Heartland Labor Forum, and I want us to get even more donations, so that number is 888-931-0901, or go online at kkfi.org. And thanks, Judy, for giving me this opportunity. This is a lot of fun.
We thank you for becoming our engineer and making us sound good, because having a good engineer is really important. And Tom's sitting right here. And Tom just made a pledge. Thank you.
I sure did. I just came back in and sat down for making a pledge, and glad to do it. Glad that the family at KKFI is working hard, and you can help out by dialing 888-931-0901.
Thank you, and that's all the time we have. Be sure to tune in next week. The show is going to be called Banned Books or Freedom to Read, and the Kansas City Fair Contractor Association. Oh, yeah, I'm doing that show. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to our engineer, Stephen Hill. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's Stand Up. And the topic is jazz and race. Special guest is Marcus Lewis.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss. And you can talk back to us, too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to Heartland Labor Forum, KKFI, at gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM.
We still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be.